What's good and welcome to the Hockey Mailbag, the first sports podcast run by you, the listeners. I'm your host, Brandon Rewicki, and each episode follows a simple format. You send me whatever hockey-related questions are on your mind, and I provide the answers. If you want to be a part of the podcast, just send your questions to thehockeymailbag@gmail.com or to me on Twitter at Brandon_Rewicki. All right, good to be back at it here with you guys in what I'm calling the eye of the storm in the hockey world. We just wrapped up the magic that was the Four Nations, but we're a week away from the frenzy of the trade deadline. So maybe a few quiet days on tap here might not be the worst thing for everybody. We'll see. We'll see how it plays out. But as you can imagine, a ton of questions to get to on both of those topics today. And I know this is primarily the show catered towards an American audience. So being Canadian, I'll do my best to keep my smugness contained. But let's put a bow on the Four Nations first. Let's see if my voice can hold up as well. Still kind of recovering from all the screaming that was done last week after Canada took down the U.S. in overtime in Boston to grab the tourney and maintain the crown amongst the best on a best in the planet. And to kick off the episode here today, Dudley gets us going. And Dudley says, on those lines, how does Canada keep edging out the U.S. in best on best? A simple question, but one that maybe has a profound answer in it. Or maybe not. I'll say this. I think it's important to note when we talk about best on, I'm not going to include the World Juniors in this, but just best on best pros playing against each other. Canada, I believe, is 5-0 in their last five championship or elimination games against the U.S. Four of those were one goal wins, a couple OT wins mixed in there. And the other one was the 0-2 Olympics, the gold medal game, 5-2 for Canada. But in all reality, that game was pretty much on a razor's edge throughout. So I guess that's kind of Dudley's point there, is how does Canada keep coming out on top when the margin is basically one goal each time? I think the simple answer is that for the vast majority of those matchups, Canada just had a profoundly better team. It was that simple, right? I mean, 0-2, the Americans had a good team. They had a home ice advantage. But I don't know, man. You look, Mario Lemieux put forward a vintage performance. Joe Sakic put a country on his back. You had Jerome Iginla, Martin Brodeur saving the day in nets. Like when your third string goalie is the all-time winningest goalie in NHL history, your team's pretty jacked up. So, like, I mean, 0-2, Canada had the better team. In the 2010-2014 Olympics, Canada certainly had the better team in both of those. I mean, 2014, yeah, that's a one-goal win in the semis, but that was the ruthlessly most efficient team maybe in hockey history, winning that one 1-0, I believe, right? And so you kind of come into this matchup here where for the first time in maybe forever, but at least in a long time, the Americans could kind of stake their claim that we have the best roster going into a winner-take-all game. And so the question then is, how does Canada find a way to get through in that one? I mean, it's not all that different from how the Americans edged out the Canadians in the first matchup. They played a hell of a game, and they got a decent amount of luck to go along with it. It really is that simple. Like I know people love to put narratives and spins and kind of stake claims as to legacies and things like that off of one game, but it was a hell of a matchup between two teams that is basically a coin flip moving forward here. You know, I think, what is it, the Packers and the Bears, where it's like, they faced off 200 times in their histories and the series is 100-100 or something like that. That's kind of how I feel Canada and the U.S. is going to be here. And in this particular matchup, the Americans weren't clinical with their chances in OT. Canada got one big one, back of the net, game over. That's pretty much it. But I don't think there's a specific edge that you can point to and say, this is why Canada keeps winning in these one-goal games. I think the four previous that we were talking about, I think the Americans did a good job to keep it to within one goal, to be honest. And this one here, maybe that's where Canada leans a little bit on the unquantifiable edge of holding the claim as the greatest hockey nation in the world. You know what I mean? Maybe there's a little bit of a psychological element at play there. But I kind of wonder if this, you know, look, the Penguins and Capitals, it was the best rivalry in the NHL for a number of years. And the Caps couldn't win. They couldn't win. They couldn't win. But then guess what? They did, right? Like, not a whole lot changed. Might have been the worst team that they had that ended up winning. But sometimes you just put yourself in enough chances with a good enough team. You find a way to push through. So I don't think it's a, you know, I guess a declarative statement that Canada will never lose to the U.S. But I just think, you know, in a winner-take-all game there, the much-maligned goaltender for Team Canada stepped up when his team needed it most and helped set the stage. And it's pretty wild, though, that in Canadian best-on-best play, that the best of the best score the most impactful goals, Crosby kind of passing the proverbial torch to McDavid in what was an all-timer of a championship game and an all-timer of a tournament there as well. So thanks for the question there, Dudley. We keep it going with the Four Nations, looking back on that tournament with at Pips421. And Pips here says, what was the USA thinking benching Kyle Connor in the final? Very good question, Pips. And don't have a great answer for you. There's a few things I do want to touch on with this topic. I guess the first would just be, what were they thinking in benching him? Hockey, maybe more than any other sport, is all about risk aversion. You know what I mean? Especially when you get further down the roster. It just feels like, and this is, I think all coaches, all GMs in the sport are victims of this, but they always want to revert to safety as opposed to game-breaking talent. They always want to think defense first as opposed to offense first. And that's the only real reason of why I can think that the U.S. would bench Kyle Connor in a game like this, that they just felt like Chris Kreider was a safer option. I think it was a major mistake. I don't know if it was the main reason the USA lost, but I'll tell you what, sure could have used the leading scorer for your country in a one-shot, one-goal game there at the end. Excuse me. But you really could have used the game-breaker that is Kyle Connor, because I'll say this. Chris Kreider was not going to win that game by the time the third period rolled around in the championship matchup, right? He hasn't had a great season for the Rangers. He's not that type of player anymore. He was not going to head out onto the ice and be the deciding factor one way or the other. Kyle Connor could have been, though. And I think it was just a complete classic overthinking of a situation there. And I don't understand why teams more often, especially in these kinds of tournaments, if you have a player like Connor who didn't play good in the tournament, I won't disagree on that notion, but like, don't you want somebody like that as your 12th forward, where if you can catch, in this case, Canada at the end of a long shift on an icing, a good matchup that you like out there, wouldn't you want to try to throw him out there late while he's fresh to change the tide of the game? I think it was a major, major oversight by the USA coaching staff. Played a bit of a role, at least, in the Americans losing the final to Canada. I'll also say this quickly. I'm a little surprised it's not getting more press on this, and maybe it's because they're kind of the darlings of the sport right now. The coaching staff made a mistake in putting Kreider in over Connor. If I'm Kyle Connor, though, I think I'm most pissed at Matthew Tkachuk. You knew you couldn't finish that game. You knew you were at less than 50%. There was a high, I'm sorry, great player, not questioning his toughness whatsoever. I just think that was the epitome of selfishness on Matthew Tkachuk's part to suit up in that game, knowing he was only going to play a handful of shifts and that he would put his team a man down for the majority of the game. I just think Kyle Connor would have had more of an impact than Matthew Tkachuk at 20%. So mistakes all around for the Americans, but it would be interesting to see if Connor could have made a difference if at the very least he was in the lineup in place for Chris Kreider. So thanks for the question there, Pips. We move on. Julia is up next, and Julia asks, who was one player that opened your eyes at the Four Nations tournament? Nice and simple. Thank you, Julia. I'll say this. When I close my eyes, I still have nightmares of Jacob Slavin playing perfect, efficient, flawless defense against my team. I never want to see Jacob Slavin on the opposition ever again. It makes me throw up every time he goes out there on the ice and his defensive flawlessness. So I'm pretty much done with Jacob Slavin. But he was, I mean, the American decor itself was completely fantastic. So I just got to give a shout out and some love to Jacob Slavin. I might go Thomas Harley, though. You know, kind of being thrown into a tough situation there. He might have been Canada's second best defenseman at the tournament, and he wasn't one of the seven picked for the team. I mean, that dude is going to be a problem. I mean, Heiskanen and Harley as a 1-2 punch is pretty ridiculous. Dallas is in a very, very nice spot on the back end moving forward there, but he is smooth. He's confident. He's not afraid to jump into the play. Like, he's aggressive, but not reckless. Ah, man, I was really, really impressed with him. And there's no doubt when you talk about who's going to be on the team come Olympic time for all these countries. Yeah, Thomas Harley is going to be a shoo-in for one of the six spots for Team Canada when things shape up and suit up in Italy in a year's time. So thanks for the question there, Julia. Next up is Willie. Ooh, and Willie has a bit of a juicy one. Willie asks, do you think Brady Tkachuk will follow his brother's lead and demand a trade out of Ottawa to an American team? I love the question there, Willie. I would say Ottawa is very, very thankful that they're in the playoff race / in a wild card spot right now, or else this would be a much, much more pressing topic. If the Sens were 6, 7, 8 points out of a playoff spot right now, I wonder if we'd already be hearing rumblings about that at the deadline, let alone going into the offseason here. I think there's a much better chance he stays with the Sens than Matthew did with Calgary. There's something to be said, regardless of where you play and the market and things like that, but being the captain and the face of a franchise is a pretty effing big deal. Like, I don't care who you are and if you want to go to the bright lights and things like that, but there is something special about being the guy for a team. And there's no guarantee that if Tkachuk were to get traded, that he would be the alpha dog. So I'm not saying that's what he wants to be, but I'm just saying from a Senator's perspective, you can kind of uniquely offer him that no other team right now can. I do think it is imperative that the Sens get to the playoffs this year and kind of maintain that moving forward, or else this becomes a bit more of a pressing discussion that I think is going to be had in the nation's capital up north. But I think Tkachuk's got 3-4 years left on his deal after this season. I mean, you can't offer him an extension until, I think it's 3 years. So you can't offer him an extension until 2 more years after this. I don't think it becomes a really, you know, serious issue that the team and the player have to discuss until a couple years from now. So at least there's that sense, fans, is that the ultimate kind of deadline on this is going to come a few years down the road. So, you know, Ottawa's obviously trying to do this, but I think it is imperative that the Sens find a way to push themselves up near the top of the Atlantic Division for the foreseeable future. But I can really see Brady being a big-time target for Chicago. I mean, wouldn't he be the perfect fit beside Connor Bedard? There's no shortage of team. I mean, if they move him, they are going to get... I would not be shocked to see them get more than what Matthew did, which is pretty crazy considering the package Florida gave up at the time there. But he is maybe the most coveted asset outside of some of the McDavid, McKinnon, Matthews of the world. Yeah, there would be a decent amount of suitors lining up to make that one happen. But thanks for the question there, Willie. And I believe this is the final one on the Four Nations here. But we go to Yaya Toure, Stan. Woo-hoo! I am a huge... I don't know how many soccer fans listen to this, but Yaya Toure was a beauty. Love the Ivory Coast midfielder. Yaya Toure, Stan, YYS, says, how could any team want to give up assets for Elias Pettersson at this point? Oh, man. I cannot imagine what it's like being a Canucks fan right now. I mean, Pettersson has had the year from hell. The thought was the Miller trade would maybe free things up mentally for him, put him in a better spot there. four nations. You get the opportunity to represent your country. You have the chance to kind of turn things around. It's a turning of a new page. And he's just crapped the bed. Like, man, it's getting to the point right now. I mean, I kind of agree with YYS there. I'm a fan of a team that is in desperate need of a number one center, and they have been for quite some time. And objectively, I don't know if I could convince myself to be happy if my team gave up legitimate assets to get Elias Pettersson. It's a sentence I never thought I would utter a year ago, but I just don't know how you can't be anything beyond majorly concerned with his level of play right now. Like, it's a long period of time that he's had these struggles, and it's rare, but it does happen for some guys in their mid to late 20s where it just, maybe it's the body kind of, you lose a little bit there. I know he's had the tendonitis, which really, really scares me if I'm being honest. There's obviously some things going on upstairs with him where, you know, he's just not operating at the same capacity as he was earlier in his career, in his early 20s. Vancouver's in a brutal spot, right? I really don't know what they do here. I think your only option if you're the Canucks, unless some team completely blows you out of the water at the deadline, is just push this till the offseason and you make a decision before that NMC kicks in. But it pains me to say it, but I'm kind of in agreement there that, like, I don't know if I'd be giving up a huge package at this point to get Pettersson and that $11.5 million contract for the next several years. He is a distressed asset. There is no doubt about it. And it's crazy. Like, Canucks fans, man, like, you went from one hell of a good looking core to Miller's out, Demko's forever injured, Pettersson could be on the chopping block, and you're left with Quinn Hughes and a bunch of guys. And that's the one guy, I mean, moving forward here, it's beyond imperative Quinn Hughes stays out west there if you're a Canucks fan, or else it's, you head into the deep, dark wilderness for a number of years. But man, what a shocking negative turnaround it's been for the Canucks since they pushed the Oilers to seven. It's a long time since they pushed the Oilers to seven games last spring. But thank you for the question there, Yaya Toure. A few more to go here, so let's keep it going. Next up is Pierce. And Pierce simply says, too early to say the Avs pulled a fast one on the Canes. I'm assuming in regards to the Rantanen Marty Nikash trade. The answer, Pierce, is yes. It is too early. It's been 8 games for Rantanen and 10 games for Nikash. And Jack Drury, I guess. But I think you'd make a lot of foolish proclamations on players, teams, and trades if you decided on them after a handful of games. Some guys light it up when they first head to a team. Some guys, it takes some time. And maybe there's a little bit more. I wonder if there's just a little more shock value on Rantanen's side. Like, Nikash has kind of been in the trade discussions for quite some time. And I could see a guy like him almost being energized with a chance to play with McKinnon. But if you're Rantanen, yes, you're kind of holding a hard line in contract negotiations, but I don't think he ever expected to actually be traded. And then you've got to wrap your mind around all that and get acclimated to a brand new playing style. A pretty unique one, by the way, as well, under Rod Brind'Amour and the Canes there. So it's going to take some time, but I think Rantanen's going to be fine. I mean, he could have 4 points in his next 2 games, and all of a sudden that would be 7 points in his first 9 games as a Hurricane. Right? You know what I mean? Like, it can just change so quickly here. I still believe in the player. I still believe in the talent. I still believe in the fit as well, to be honest. I kind of like it a little more on Colorado's side now that we've seen both of these guys in action on their new teams. But I'm still believing that Mikko's going to have a big impact for Carolina here. I'm also not of the mind that they're going to move him. I just don't see a trade out there that really makes sense. I think they're going cup or bust in Carolina this year, and I kind of like that, even with the uncertainty around Mikko Rantanen's contract headed into a UFA situation this summer. So thanks for the question there, Pierce. All right, a few more to go. McDaddy, I wonder where this might go. McDaddy asks, just kind of tells me, it's not even a question, it's a statement. McDaddy says, please tell me the Oilers aren't going to run back the same goaltending for another cup run this year. Well, McDaddy, I don't know if it's the real McDaddy or not, but here's what I'll say on that. If I was running the Edmonton Oilers, I would pretty firmly be able to tell you that we would not be running back the same goaltending for another cup run. I just don't think Stuart Skinner's that guy. Or it's too big of a risk. It's too big of a jump to make. I get them doing it last year, right? Like he'd shown some glimpses here and there. But this was really the main... You were giving Stuart Skinner basically a season-long audition to show that, I mean, you could be the starting goalie for what could potentially be a dynastic team. I mean, you look at guys like McDavid and Dreisaitl's caliber, and they generally win not one, but multiple Stanley Cups, right? Like, it was a big opportunity, and we've basically just seen the same guy as we've seen, throughout his NHL career, where he's good in spots, he's solid, but just too many of those back-breaking goals that are given up. And I just think at this point, if you're Edmonton, there might not be a better time to win the Cup than now. I just don't know how many more chances you're going to get with Dreisaitl playing at the level that he is, McDavid. I mean, Ekholm Bouchard as a pair. Darnell Nurse is playing great, kind of under the radar great this year. I think he go all in. Here's an interesting one, though. I wonder if maybe you don't go after the name we're all thinking in John Gibson out of Anaheim. But maybe you give Doug Armstrong a call. Now that Connor McDavid is seen up close and personal what Jordan Binnington can do in a big game. I wonder if maybe that's the move. Maybe you extract a little payback too with the offer sheets. Like, I don't know, but I might be maybe giving St. Louis a bit of a shout, seeing if you can get Jordan Binnington into the picture there. At the very least, I know regular season-wise numbers are pretty the same, you know, pretty much the same. Skinner and Binnington. I do think Binnington's been a little more hard done by the team in front of him in St. Louis. And it's kind of hard to argue with the fact that when the lights get bright and the pressure's there, the dude finds a way to elevate his game. And that's the kind of goaltender they're going to need, Edmonton, when they make another run for the Cup this spring. So I think I'd be making a healthy run at Binnington if I'm Edmonton and Stan Bowman there. But to be honest, if Gibson was my only option, I'm going after John Gibson too. I just don't envision a scenario where Skinner and Calvin Pickard are good enough to get past the Vegases, the Winnipegs, you know, whoever else, Dallas, Colorado, and then the Eastern team as well there. I just don't know if it's going to hold up over the course of four series. So I think you need to pretty heavily go the route of what McDaddy's saying there and bring a Tendy in to shore things up and officially get that bling and cup and ring back to Edmonton after a 35, oh my gosh. I keep thinking the 90s are 20 years away, but a 35-year cup drought out there in Alberta. But thanks for the question there, McDad. Three more to go here. Next up, at Duel, D-O-O-L, at Duel. Thanks for the question, Duel. Duel asks, if you're Barry Trotz, what route do you go? Do you make your picks, add to the roster? What is this team, the Predators, in the short-term future? Interesting question there, Duel. You got a few in there. Bang for your buck. I love it. I guess when you say, do you make your picks, you're talking about the three first-rounders that Nashville has in this upcoming draft. Here's the route I would go, and I wonder if Trouts is maybe kind of thinking along the same lines. I mean, we're both Manitoba boys, so we might be on a similar wavelength here. But look, it's been the season from hell. Everything that could go wrong has gone wrong. I think you just kind of accept that at this point, and this season becomes a punt, and you move on to next year. I think the Predators need to get faster and younger up front. They'll have the ability to do that with some of those picks. I think talking about the three first-rounders, first off, you obviously don't move your own pick if you're Nashville. Like, it's going to be a top three, worst case top four selection. You're going to get, for a team that really hasn't had that guy, the opportunity to draft your number one centerman of the future is going to be too enticing to pass up. So you're bringing somebody like that in. And that might be as good of a situation for a high pick to come into if you're a centerman there, where you can learn if they don't move anybody. You can learn from Ryan O'Reilly and Steven Stamkos and kind of ease your way in and be mentored by a couple of beauties that have been around the block and won a thing or two. That would be about as ideal of a situation as you could imagine for maybe a James Higgins or a Michael Misa, whoever that might be there. So I think you keep your number one for sure, for sure, for sure. I do think, though, that as well, Nashville can get aggressive with at least one of those other first rounders, maybe even two, to be honest, because you ask as well, Duel, what is this team in the short term future? Short term, they're pretty old as hell. Like, it's not a super young team. And I mean, but you're also not going to be able to get out of a lot of these contracts. So I think you kind of look at this as more of a one off than a true definition of what your franchise is. You get a little younger, you get a little faster, and you hope UC Saros gets back to Vezina winning form. And that can solve a lot of problems if you're a team at the bottom of the standings there. So I don't think it's as doom and gloom as a lot of people are predicting, but I think the Preds are going to very, very greatly benefit from having a likely top three selection of the draft this year. So thanks for the question. Duel, two more to go. Let's try to finish this in under 30. Lance is up next. And Lance says, everybody talks about Vancouver and Calgary battling for the last playoff spot, but should Winnipeg be more concerned about Utah sneaking into the final wild card? Lance, the answer is absolutely yes. I don't know if there's anybody out there right now that if you had to rank those three teams, who would you rather face in the opening round? I think Utah is overwhelmingly the team that you would least like to face out of those three. I mean, if they did get in, you've got a young, fast, skillful, naive group of players in a brand new location, potentially riding the wave of emotion that can come with their first playoff matchup. That's just too much. There's too many potential roadblocks there that I don't want to try to jump over. There's too many grenades that I got to skip in and around there that I would want to worry about that after winning the President's Trophy. So, Utah, no doubt, that's, I think, the last wildcard team that the Jets want to face as far as the final team to get into the dance there. The interesting one, I think, about the question that you didn't ask is, would you rather face Vancouver or Calgary? I think at this point, wouldn't you rather face the Canucks out of any of those teams after everything we've touched on there? Like, I know there's a lot of talent, but it just seems like an absolute Murphy's Law type of a season. And at least the Flames can say, look, we've got Dustin Wolf, and we've seen rookie goaltenders before steal series in the NHL playoffs. I think I'd be gunning for the Canucks to get in if I'm Winnipeg over those other three teams. That would be an amazing series, though, and an amazing story to see the Jets go up against Utah. I mean, the playoff atmosphere in Winnipeg is unlike just about anything else in all of sports. If you haven't been, you absolutely must. But Utah could be a pretty unique and interesting situation there in their first taste of playoff hockey as well. So that would be a fun series. I wouldn't mind seeing that happen. And I think the NHL would be pretty happy with that situation playing out. So we'll keep an eye on that. But thanks for the question there, Lance. And finally, we wrap things up with at Susie Q. And Susie Q, well, a lot of people might be happy with this potential outcome of her question. But Susie Q asks, at what point do we start to worry that Chicago goes the route of the Buffalo Sabres in brackets, 10 plus straight playoff misses? Well, Susie, I think I speak for the vast majority of the population outside of Illinois in saying that I do not worry at all about that, because that would be a tremendous outcome. I kind of kid. But I would say as a fan, I don't think you necessarily... You know what? I don't even think that's true. I think you legitimately do have to worry about that possibility. I think if you're Chicago management, that needs to be your number one priority moving forward here is... screw the tank and the draft picks and all that stuff. Get some freaking guys that can play and get them in the lineup immediately. I think you are. And this is these are some of the pit. I know everybody, maybe this is more of a young person thing too, but I always think when everybody says, you know, when a team's in a situation, they've got aging vets, bad contracts, things like that, the easy and common answer is just tank, tank, tank. Tear it down to the studs. Anybody that can get a pick, bring them in. And then we figure out the rest after we draft a couple of superstars. It is so easy to say, and it is so difficult to actually execute, because the Sabres obviously are the prime example of that. But there's also several teams that took forever and ever to get out of. Like, it paid off for the Avalanche, but it took them 10 years. It took them 10 years, basically, since they started making number one picks to get back into it. I mean, Pittsburgh almost ceased to exist as a franchise before getting Crosby and Malkin. It is easy to do, I think, in theory and practice. And I think a lot of GMs look good at the start when they, hey, we've got 3 first-round picks in the next 2 years and all these prospects and all these kids. The future is bright. None of them will fail to live up to their potential. But then what ends up happening? They all don't hit, every single one of them. And you're in the spot that Chicago's at now, where you've got a clearly overburdened and overworked Connor Bedard, who's still trying to find his way at 19, 20 years old in the NHL, carrying a team with really little to no talent whatsoever. I think it's definitely time for concern in Chicago. I know Seth, even like the Seth Jones situation, I know Seth Jones is clearly not worth the $9 million that he's being paid. But you move him and you get, I assume, very little back. You don't really have many difference makers on the back end. You look up front, outside of Bedard. Who are the big difference makers there? Like, they're kind of, I know they've got Levshunov coming in, Korchinski on the back end. There's some help coming in on the back end there in Chicago, but they don't have 3 or 4 can't miss guys coming up in the pipeline just yet. Like, they're still a long ways away from becoming an actual force in the NHL. And I think it's imperative that they, this offseason, maybe even at this deadline, find guys that can just get you wins now. Like, put a pause and put a cork in. What are we going to do in 4 or 5 years? What are we going to do in 2 to 3 months? Like, let's try to get some positivity and good vibes in that locker room, in that organization. And then we can build off of that and worry about things down the road. But this is, yeah, Chicago, I think, certainly, and Hawks fans have every right to be a little bit concerned about how this rebuild is playing out. They're kind of at a pivot point, I think, right? And now this upcoming 6-7 months is going to be absolutely massive in determining whether or not this is going to be a successful rebuild or a long, long path into the wilderness, which can be difficult to come out of, even if you have somebody as transcendently talented as Connor Bedard is. So thank you for the question. A beauty there, Susie Q, to wrap things up there. And that's where we'll end it for the podcast episode today. Thank you guys so much for tuning in once again to another episode of the Hockey Mailbag. As always, appreciate getting to hang out with you beauties. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to be a part of the podcast, just send your questions to hockeymailbag@gmail.com or to me on Twitter @Brandon_Rewicki. We'll be back at it next week, Thursday morning, with our final episode before the trade deadline. We'll be dropping one 24 hours before the deadline takes place. So let's hear your proposals. Let's hear your madness. And we'll get into all the fun topics ahead of one of the best days on the hockey calendar. Until then, though, I'm your host, Brandon Rewicki. And as always, look forward to talking puck with you guys real soon.